Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I will be your moderator for today's program called The New Middle East. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our highly distinguished guests. Dr. Ellen Mendoza is the founder and executive director of a leading foreign policy think tank in the UK, the Henry Jackson Society. A graduate of Cambridge University, he's also a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. Ellen is a frequent speaker and analyst on television, including the BBC, Sky, CNBC, Al Jazeera, and Bloomberg, just to name a few. His areas of expertise cover the transatlantic relationship, the Middle East, domestic and international security, and defense. And, of course, Douglas Murray, who we alumni as Cambridge boys like to say he studied at the other place, Oxford. He's the associate director of the Henry Jackson Society, an accomplished author, a playwright, a journalist. He can regularly be found in print from The Guardian on the one hand to The Spectator on the other. Douglas also appears frequently on British flagship TV shows, such as BBC's Question Time, This Week, Hard Talk, and The Today Programme. Gentlemen, it's a genuine pleasure to welcome you to the Bay Area.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, we are here to talk about the new Middle East. And I've always wondered, given the continual strife in the area, going back historically, religiously, culturally, etc., what is new about the Middle East today that we actually haven't seen in virtually past millennia? Douglas?
Gosh. Well, first of all, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club. And I'm sorry not to be here next month, by the way, to hear about Petra. It's absolutely true. You couldn't possibly be disappointed on a visit to Petra. And I think you couldn't possibly be disappointed in a talk about Petra. But it's a nice and easy question to start with.
short answer, right? Yes.
Well, of course, I mean, there's a certain bogusness about the title, of course, because, I mean, nothing is new in the Middle East, and most of the things we're witnessing at the moment are just iterations of issues that have come up many, many times before. I mean, I think it's interesting that now, I mean, had we been having this discussion even a couple of years ago, there would probably still have been some version of the idea that recent events across the region were somehow going to have shaken the kaleidoscope and it might turn out in an utterly different way. And I don't think anybody would hold that view now. In every country that saw events since 2011, they've fallen out in almost entirely unpredictable ways, unless you, in each case, knew the particular country well enough, in which case, in each case, you could pretty much predict what was going to happen. But the underlying issues across the region in each of the countries remains specific and, in most cases, insoluble, to my view.
Do you agree with that, insoluble?
Solvable only in very difficult circumstances. But to come back to the question, the new Middle East, I think the reason it's an interesting period in the Middle East is because I think we're ending a period of a century where an artificial construct was placed on the Middle East. And that derives, obviously, from the Sykes-Picot agreement of 1916 and how that got carried out. The division of the Middle East into, I suppose, artificial nation states, created at the whim of the great powers, Britain and France in particular, with the aim of, I suppose, westernizing the Middle East in a way that at the time we thought was possible. But of course what that meant was setting up client states effectively with monarchies in most cases who would do our bidding. That's essentially the sort of the history of 100 years ago. Now, what you've seen, I think, in the last 15 years is the gradual disintegration of that system. And what do I mean by that? Well, you've seen, obviously, countries like Iraq essentially disappear. Yes, they still exist in terms of a federal structure. But if you look at Iraq since the days, I suppose, of the fall of Saddam, even before Saddam, you had the Kurdistan area, which was essentially self-governing. You now have that, of course, a reality today. You have a Shia and a Sunni bit. The Sunni bit is somewhat ruled by ISIS, which has captured parts of it, of course. You've got a Shia-led government that's sectarian and ethnic in its sort of composition, that is leading the drive to recapture the rest of the country. It doesn't work as a country anymore. Syria doesn't work as a country anymore. The Syrian civil war is proof of this. You have essentially an Alawite strip state running on the seaward side of the country. You have the minorities having largely fled or congregating now in ever fewer places. It's not the Kurds have got their own bit again. It seems that you're seeing the breakdown after 100 years of that, and that causes, I think, all of us to bear in mind how we look at the Middle East, how we understand it. And against that, you also saw the movement of the Arab Spring, which, of course, fizzled out into Arab winter, for want of a better word, but was based on very noble goals. It wasn't started by radical Islamists. It came from a genuine desire of ordinary people to want to be free, free of the repression of the secret state, freedom to pursue economic opportunity they hadn't been able to pursue. And that was also new. You hadn't seen that spontaneous outburst in the way that, if you like, of the gasp of liberalism in the region. It promised something when it didn't happen. It didn't come about. But you can sense that things had changed, even though the genie has been put back in the bottle in places like Egypt. For how long is the question? So I think we see that there are the huge problems Douglas mentions. There may be some opportunities as well, but so far we've kind of flunked those opportunities. The challenges have not been met, and the region arguably is more complicated and more dangerous than it has been for some time.
I want to come back to that issue of not meeting our obligations or taking the opportunities, but in a sense, stemming from what you're telling us, isn't it fair to say that perhaps allegiances out there in the Middle East are forged with almost every dawn, and consequently there could be unlikely and unexpected alliances and agreements, even between possibly mortal enemies who are doing this as a tactical maneuver?
Well, that's certainly true. There are two trends there. One is, as you say, a sort of alliance of even of opponents, as long as they have some mutual enemy in common, which is not uncommon in the region or anywhere else in world politics. The other part of that, though, is that there is a falling down along certain lines, which Alan alluded to, and which I remember I wrote about some time ago. At the beginning of the Arab Spring, I wrote a piece recalling a conversation I had some years ago with a member of the SIS, MI6 in the UK, who I had said some years earlier, what's your deepest fear for the Middle East? And this person said that their deepest fear was that the region would clarify. And I think that fear has come true, that there is a clarifying along ethnic, sectarian, confessional lines, which some people think they will benefit from, but I think there's much to be dismayed about in that setup. But of course, beyond that, there is a constant struggle for dominance in the region, which leads to very surprising things, and perhaps most surprisingly, earlier this year, the public handshake between Prince Turki Al-Faisal and Bogey Allon in the Munich Security Conference, which was a photograph that you couldn't imagine having been able to be seen even 6 months earlier.
Right, thank you for that. Well, coming back then to the point you made, Alan, about missed opportunities, do you care to explain and perhaps adumbrate a little bit about why you see missed opportunities on the part of perhaps Western leadership?
Yeah, of course. I think we had an opportunity when the Arab Spring came about. Had we at the time essentially endorsed the movements, the liberal movements who had appeared at the beginning of it, ordinary people, come and said, look, we're on your side, the dictators have to go, but crucially, we're here to help you forge the next step, which is a transitional step between what you have now and a democracy. It's not to go straight to democracy. You can't build a democracy in 2 minutes. It's not possible. But you have to have the sense of being able to bring people along with you, make, you know, people understand the bases of what makes for constitutional societies, you know, the sort of understanding about rights, how they work, property rights, civil rights, legal rights, along those lines. We missed that chance. When you saw people protest, we stood on the sidelines, and I have to say the Americans led this, I'm afraid, under President Obama, saying, we're not going to take charge of this. Maybe, perhaps, maybe rightfully learning from lessons in the past, possibly, except taking, as always, when you learn lessons from the past, you always learn the wrong lessons from the past. You always pick, it's like interventionism. You always look at the one that happened the one before rather than the one, two, or three before. You know, it's sort of inevitability to that. So we didn't get engaged. And what that meant was that when, firstly, the ordinary people
How would you have wanted him to get engaged?
Very simple. Egypt under Mubarak was a classic case in point here. A classic case in point. Here you had someone who had been an American client for many years, but who'd clearly lost control of the country. Now, the one thing, if you're going to have a dictator as a client, the dictator has to be able to keep control of the country. He hadn't. He lost. Mm. So therefore, for the Americans to kind of sit on the fence and go, well, we're not sure if we're for him or against him at that point, was a bad mistake. It meant you weren't with the aspirations of the people. That wasn't there straight away. And it also meant that you weren't keeping your previous policy of backing the dictator. So I would have been happy had the Americans come out and said, and the British and others come out and said, we want to be with the people here. It's time for change. You've got to move on. And let's bring in a more consensual style of government, help you with the constitutional developments and beyond there. Give me another example, Libya. As you know, in Libya, we, and I say we the Europeans, led the sort of charge into Libya when Mr. Gaddafi said, I'm going to kill everyone, basically. You know, we're going to go house to house, we're going to kill the rebels, and we decided, Britain and France decided, that wasn't a very good thing in the 21st century to allow mass murder to happen, we're going to do something. Mr. Obama famously was leading from behind in Libya, which did, by the way, prove to be very useful, because it turned out that the British and French couldn't run the military operation without the Americans doing things in the background. So it was, if you like, a joint allied approach. A lot of Arab states, of course, joined in as well, played that role. But what happened the minute we had, in a sense, won the military campaign? We withdrew. We didn't help Libya build a constitutional government. We just said, off you go, guys, get on with it. Is it any surprise, therefore, that Libya today is, you know, turning into the number one jihadist sort of venue because Syria's, you know, diminishing, Libya's becoming more obvious? Of course not. We didn't take the opportunity provided. We didn't help people who wanted to grasp constitutional government, participatory forms of government, and we left them to it. It's no surprise, therefore, that they've ended up in the way they have done. I'm not saying it would have been a panacea. By the way, you know, if you get involved, you create different sets of problems, but you decide what sets of problems you want to manage. That's what intervention's about. And non-intervention, by the way, is the corollary of that. By not intervening, you also have to choose the circumstances and choose the challenges you meet. And again, Syria is a good example. We didn't get involved in Syria, and look what happened there. Worse, perhaps, than what's happened in Libya when we did get involved. So, you know, it's about picking the challenges and choosing. And we didn't pick the right challenges, in my view, over the last 5-10 years. And as a result, we are in a mess.
Just add to that, I mean, I have a slightly bleaker view than Alan about some of this. I mean, it's my view that, I mean, our much diminished ambitions should be borne in mind here, in that in this country and in my country, we clearly don't have the desire to be in countries like this for very much time. We don't have the attention spans. We don't actually produce the class of young person who wants to go and absorb themselves in these countries and in their futures. We're very limited in our attention spans. And to that extent, it's appropriate that one might rein in one's ambitions. The interesting thing, of course, is that at the same time that you might describe it as a post-2003 blowback at home in our opinions about where we can have a utility emerge, that itself then goes around another kick of the circle. If you look around in Europe today, what is the country that is most keen on intervention? France. Now, if 10 years ago we'd been sitting here and I'd have told you that, you'd have said I was drinking. But why is it? For very obvious reasons. France did not want to intervene in the Middle East then. After recent events, not least on the territory of the French Republic, intervention in Syria is, to a great extent, led from the Quai d'Orsay. So it's about the events that happen, and our own response to this is bound to be predicated on that.
You've raised in the past, Douglas, a rather prickly, I would say, matter, which I think you're probably well known for, either in support or against, by coming out very strongly against Islam. And I was just wondering whether you might share with the audience, how you've arrived at these views, if indeed I am presenting that correctly, and secondly, why you feel that Islamophobia, again, if I'm not misquoting you, is actually a misnomer.
You're slightly misrepresenting me, or rather significantly on the first bit at any rate. I'm not against Islam. My contention is that all monotheisms, all religions, have foundational problems, which all the religions have to face up to. And that although by no means have the other monotheisms entirely faced up to their problems, it's more comprehensively faced up to. So, for instance, let me give you a couple of examples. When a Florida pastor says something deeply unpleasant about a minority group, no major religious figure comes out in defense of that person. The Archbishop of Canterbury does not say that Mr. Phelps in Florida is correct. He doesn't pass any water for that person. Is it passing water the correct phrase? Nearly.
Carrying
water. He neither passes nor carries water to the Florida pastor.
I'm sure you haven't been drinking.
And it's the same, I would argue, mainly in the Jewish religion. I mean, occasionally you'll find there is a rabbi in Svat or somewhere in North England, Israel, who will say something appalling. Most of the other rabbis in the world will not only not support that, but will condemn that rabbi. They will actually cast him out. I think there are foundational problems in Islam, as in other religions, which Islam and followers of Islam are very reluctant to face up to, and very reluctant for some understandable reasons. It's exceedingly painful. But nevertheless, they must be faced up to. And let me give you a very quick example of this. 2 Decembers ago, a brave young Jordanian pilot was shot down over ISIS-controlled airspace. You'll remember that he was then savagely murdered, burned alive by these barbarians of ISIS. Now, I mention this because what was the response? If you looked for a school of learning or an authority in the Islamic world, you might look, for instance, to the University of Al-Azhar in Cairo. Al-Azhar had deep discussions about the appropriate response to the burning of that brave young Jordanian pilot. Among the responses was a statement from Al-Azhar that the young pilot who'd been killed should be avenged by his killers being crucified or having alternate legs and arms cut off. The crime specifically of burning a body being the defiling of a body, which is a sin. And Al-Azhar went on to explain that ISIS, these barbarians who'd killed this young Jordanian, should be described as terrorists. It was right to describe them as terrorists, but they are not to be described as heretics. And this, to my mind, points to a very, very deep and very serious problem, which we all understandably want to avoid the consequences of. But I simply urge that we can't. We have to be very careful in dealing with this. We have to be very nuanced. We have to be thoughtful of consequences of dealing with it. But one cannot as a society, I think, legitimately defend the idea of perpetrating lies or not telling truths where you see them. And on this matter, I think that it's very important that our societies, on all aspects of religion, like national security, do not institute fibs about things which we see. And that's a minority position for the time being. But
thank you for that. And actually talking about ISIS and also talking about consequences, we're all very well aware that ISIS controls Raqqa, and they are doing their very best to establish a caliphate, not just in northern Syria, but across Syria, and export this to the world and back into your home turf in Europe. And I wonder where you see that all going. In fact, if I may, you guys were on the plane last night, and Sky News broke a story, an exclusive, and I'm not sure you might have caught up with this, that they've obtained secret documents, some of them handwritten orders, actually, which demonstrate that ISIS is in total cahoots and colluding with the Syrian government, with the Russian hand stirring, and that they are planning very rather large strategic targets to hit across Europe and beyond, and that they already have, and for years have been cultivating sleeper cells across Europe in order to implement these attacks. What is your view of those developments?
Well, there's a number of different developments in that. It's nothing. Firstly, it's nothing new. Although it may have been an exclusive breaking story, they may have found new documents.
Yes.
But we've been aware of this for some time. The Syria issue. It's been quite obvious from day one that President Assad has been in cahoots with ISIS, as both sides see each other as the best guarantor of ending up just as a one-on-one fight against the other versus all the remnants of the moderate, whatever scheme of rebels you have, ranging from very moderate to almost extreme rebels in between, who would lead to a better Syria going forwards. And from day one, Assad released radical Islamists from jail in order to encourage the Islamist insurgency. He specifically continued to trade oil with them. He made sure they were financially secure, because it was in his interests to make it a fight between his so-called moderate regime and ISIS, because that would be his way of saying to the West, you must back me after all, basically. The truth is that as the war's gone on, he's been more and more exposed as having been the facilitator, not the inhibitor of ISIS, and yet another reason why he should go, why it's been disgraceful, we haven't forced him out, why, as long as he remains in power, the Syrian civil war will continue and many more thousands will die. And that is very sad, but that is a relationship of that. And of course, that war is the primary radicalizing influencer in the West today. The reason young Muslims from Western countries are going off to Syria is to fight in the jihad against Assad. That is what they're being radicalized for. If you look at the propaganda used, it's about coming to fight and create the caliphate. It's against Assad. Of course, ultimately, it's against all of us, but he's the proximate reason it's there. The atrocities he does, the barrel bombs, all these things are what ISIS use in order to recruit. Now, sadly, they have had significant success in terms of bringing young Western indigenous populations to go and fight for them there. And the problem with this is very simple. It may be some of them will get killed over there, and we know a number of terrorists who obviously from Western countries who have been killed, often by the countries of their origin, having actually conducted that. But what's concerning is that the number one determinant of successful terrorist operations in the West is by those people who've had military training. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a study we've done for many years looking at those who have been convicted of terrorist crimes, and what you discover is that military training is the key part to whether you are going to successfully be able to carry out a terrorist attack or not. It's notable, for example, the Paris attacks, the Brussels attacks were led by those who'd had combat experience in Syria. Okay, without that, all kinds of things go wrong. You can't prime a bomb properly. You don't know how to handle firearms. It becomes a very different case in point. Security services can get the upper hand on you. So the more young Western Muslims who go and fight in Syria, the more get combat trained, the more then come back. And they're not coming back, frankly, to go and become mailmen or, sort of run their local convenience store. No, they're coming back to continue in this vein. And the worst part of this is, indeed, the sleeper cells who we don't even know about, essentially, the identities of people who are in Europe, who are there to cause problems and to continue this battle, even if they get driven out of Syria and Iraq, which looks like very slowly it will happen. So the problem is that we've now created a conundrum for ourselves. We have now large Muslim populations in the West. A small subsection of those, a subsection of those support some of the goals, and survey after survey shows this, of ISIS, even if they're not prepared to be violent themselves. A much smaller subsection are happy to actually carry out or, if you like, facilitate those attacks. And that means that you have now a number of potential terrorist suspects living in Western countries who could, at some point, carry out those attacks. It's a deep concern for all of us. to concern here in the US as well.
Yeah, I'd love to continue this theme, but I also want to address the elephant in the room from my point of view, which is Iran, which we really haven't discussed in any detail today. They are meddling wherever they can, but I want to specifically relate back to Israel, whereby the Israeli leadership stood shoulder to shoulder against doing the Iran nuclear deal. Were they wrong?
Perhaps I could preface this by saying that actually I think about the only regional beneficiary of the events that were called the Arab Spring has been the Iranian regime, which has been able to very significantly extend its influence in the region. By the way, may I preface it by a second preface, which is how interesting it is that in a discussion on the Middle East, it's actually taken until now to mention Israel. And I say this not as a criticism, but just as an interesting observation. You see, for most of my adult life, whenever anyone said the Middle East problem, everyone knew what they were talking about. And I often used to say, you know, which Middle East problem? Which one are you talking about? But people used to think it was a sort of cutesy point. And now, of course, you can't say the Middle East problem. Which one? Where do we start? So everyone's aware of this now, and I think everyone is aware of the fact that there is not, as the paradigm used to be, claimed to be in the 2000s and in the late 1990s, that there was this sort of key to unlocking all of the problems, solving all of the problems in the Middle East, which was that if you just found the right key and you got the PA and the Israelis to the correct deal, you know, you could turn it and suddenly, you know, the economy of the Yemen would boom, you know, the Saudis would see the point of women's rights, you know, and so on. So this point has become visible. We'll see and know this now. The question of the Israelis coming out entirely, I think they were right to come out entirely against the deal and were right to say so. By the way, there's been an amusing conversation in our country recently because your president came to London last week, the week before, and made a very public intervention into the EU debate and were much amused at the fact that President Obama said it was quite appropriate as a friend and ally to come to London and tell us how to vote in the referendum in June, because some of us remember that he hadn't been so happy when the Prime Minister of the State of Israel went to Washington and gave his view. But yes, of course, I mean, they were right to come out against the deal. It's very early days with the deal, but it's going to have consequences for a long time to come. By the way, I should stress that from the from specifically local point of view in the UK, it is very concerning to us that one of the first things that's happened in recent months and since the deal was an upping of the fatwa, the bounty for the head of Salman Rushdie, the British novelist, which is a point, I think, of appropriate concern and something which doesn't get mentioned enough, that a British novelist could still be living in fear of his life for writing a novel, which is no business of the government of Iran or any other government, and no business of any newspapers in Iran to suborn his murder for publishing a novel. But anyhow, this is just one of the very early signs of something which happens and which we now seem to have to accept.
Alan, do you see the West being able to stand up to Iran as it inexorably gets eventually to a nuclear threshold, given the current march, unless something intercedes, of course, but nonetheless the firing of potential intercontinental missiles, testing them, and we aren't really doing anything about that. That's not part of the deal, but it certainly is part of the United Nations resolutions that they aren't allowed to do that. And a rather facile response so far has been forthcoming.
Well, I'm tempted to say to this one, ask me again in about 8 months' time.
I'll remember.
Once you have a new president, because it's quite clear that under the current president, the answer is no. In fact, this current president has made it his watchword to avoid any kind of confrontation with Iran or with most other people, hoping, I imagine, that that will be his legacy, sort of. But the problem is that, you know, legacy unfolds over a great number of years. And while he may leave office having, you know, sort of kept things quiet, what he has essentially done is embolden Iran. And yes, you've pointed out the missile launches, other things in that way. Iran has had a long history of obviously cheating on nuclear issues, even when it was supposed to be, you know, having deals of various kinds. That will have to be monitored, of course, to see how that works. But you have to look at the behavior right now. And what, you know, Douglas has pointed out in terms of the fatwa was one thing. What Iran has been doing across the Middle East in terms of funding insurgencies in Yemen, where it supports the Houthi rebels.
The increase in the bounties to Palestinian terrorists.
The increase in bounties there. The continued drive for Hezbollah to dominate not just Lebanon, but to prop up Assad in Syria as well, to kind of, you know, interfere in that area. Other, you know, activities in Bahrain and other places. This is not a regime in Iran that wants to sit back in its box and enjoy the benefits of economic growth. The money it will get from sanctions relief will not be used to, you know, kind of promote the welfare of the Iranian people. It will be spent on military machinery and in furthering the goals of the regime in the region and beyond. So we have gone into this deal, presumably in the full knowledge, that that is what Iran will engage and be active in. At present, we don't appear to have the ability to stand up to that. Whether that changes in 8 months' time is, I think, the key question for the next 5-10 years. Because if it doesn't, you will see, as Douglas said, Iran being not the beneficiary of just the Arab Spring, but indeed it will likely become the regional dominant power in the Middle East. And for all that means for Israel, for the Gulf states, for Europe, for terrorism internationally, and the rest of it.
I'm conscious that in all discussions there's a terrible paucity of questions, of course, from the audience. But as you
yeah,
sift through the pile...
Not today.
But if I just add that very briefly, one thing which I haven't read from any American commentator, I may have missed, but I throw it out there, is that... If one takes the view that your president saw something, an opening, a crack in the grim facade of the regime in Iran, I still don't know what it was. I just say this because every country that is as it were brought in from the cold, there's always something that is seen. Nixon saw something in the face of the Chinese leadership. Indeed, Ted Heath did in the UK. Margaret Thatcher saw something in the face of Gorbachev. I'd still love to know what it was that your president saw, what the sign was that gave him the idea that this was a deal which could ever work. And I've read a lot of commentary on this, but I've not read anyone who's explained that.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. And unfortunately, we have to now curtail our conversation. Wow, these are piling up. We've got a fairly limited time to ask questions from the audience, so I'm going to do my best. I apologize if I can't get through all of them or if I slightly curtail some of the questions.
Do them in batches, maybe.
Right. It seems that in the midst... this is a question from a member in the audience. It seems that in the midst of all this turmoil, Iran is the most stable country and very opposed to ISIS. If that is the case, maybe we should look to working more closely with the Iranians. Who wants to field that?
Well, very quickly, if I may... there is this line of thought that the primary threat is ISIS, and that in order to defeat them, you would need to ally with absolutely anyone. I think at the very least, one ought to be careful ever about allying with the very commanders who are behind the blowing up of so many of your own soldiers only a matter of months and years earlier. And generally speaking, it's an unwise idea to take such a course of action. Some of the very people who the Americans have been allying with are precisely the people who killed their own men. And you would have to believe that ISIS was, as occasionally leaders have misspoken, an existential threat now to make such an accommodation, it would seem to me. But it might be a demonstration of, again, our short-termism and our attention span problems. Somebody cuts off somebody's head in the Middle East, and we all say, we're going to deal with this problem. When all the time, a much bigger issue may be a much larger and more ambitious regime elsewhere. I put it out there as a hypothetical, obviously.
And I'll also say that, you know, Iran is, to call it a stable regime, is also, I think, an error, just simply because if you look at where the Arab Spring started, it didn't start in any Arab country. It started in Iran in 2009 with the Green Revolution that was so brutally put down, where we missed yet another opportunity to do anything, just sort of allowed people to be massacred, essentially, the brutal crackdown that followed. And then the second time we had an opportunity was when a policy of sanctions which had shown it was working over a period of years was literally given away over the nuclear deal, when having forced the regime literally to come to terms with the fact that economic disaster was looming for it, there would have been further unrest in the streets, further instability, in other words, and then we gave the get-out-of-jail card for a very limited sort of time-bound deal in return. It's almost a case of, you know, so much effort was put into assembling that sanctions regime in order to make, you know, the country get into a place, and then we extracted so little for it in return. It does seem to me an extraordinary sort of extraordinarily bad negotiating tactic to have gone that way. And in a sense, you know, Iran is now more stable purely because of our own, you know, in one case, inactivity, in another case, because of our own activity in helping it get to that position.
Speaking of activity, here's a question. You're both interventionists. Given that Europe has felt the consequences of the Syrian war in terms of the migrant crisis and terrorism, much more so than the United States, do you support a European-led military intervention in Syria?
Well, that's a very, I mean, that we could spend the rest of the 20 minutes talking about that.
Take two.
So, as interventionists, essentially, well, Douglas will take probably a slightly different line to me on Syria. I backed intervention in Syria from a very, very early stage, right from the very beginning, saying it was quite obvious that Assad lost control, was going to do all the things that he then subsequently did. It was going to lead to repercussions for us whether we intervened or not. We'd better do the right thing, therefore, and actually remove the one thing that was the impediment to at least moving the political system forward in Syria. So I was a backer of it in 2011, 2012, 2013, at the time when we had the famous red line drawn. He used chemical weapons. By the way, he used chemical weapons just last week, despite allegedly not having any anymore. Interesting, that. But, you know, I was in favour of that, and it would have made a big difference. A military intervention now, it's quite unclear what that might serve right now in, you know, how would it work? What would it look like exactly? Who are we taking on? The Russians? Are we taking on the Russians if we're going in right now? I think the best we could do right now in Syria is to create a set of safe havens for refugees in the northern part of the country, which we could enforce, which we could do without Russia, without needing Russia's say-so on the matter. Setting that up and then attempting to create some kind of viable alternative structure in Syria. Again, the Europeans don't really have the wherewithal to do it on their own. It would require American assistance, which comes back to my 8 months time point. And it is still something I think that's going to be badly needed in order to move the civil war to a close.
My own very brief thing. I've always been opposed to any Western intervention in Syria other than destroying ISIS when they are a threat to our cities. I've always been against intervention in Syria after the first few weeks, after which I thought that the opportunity had gone. Because my own view is that we would be left in ownership of something we did not want to own, which is an uncomfortable, unpleasant thing to be in, and neither your country nor my country or the French want to own Syria effectively, and we don't know what we'd do with it, we don't know who we'd encourage to put in charge, and so on and so forth. So it's best not to have that put at your doorstep. That having been said, many people seem to have blamed us for it anyway. I mean, it is one of the strangenesses of current discourse that the West is blamed when it does intervene and when it doesn't. But my own view is that I cannot understand how European countries have been persuaded that they have to take responsibility for the falling apart of Syria. And although I think we should do everything we can, and Britain happens to be the second largest international aid giver to efforts in the region to support Syrian refugees, and I think that's quite appropriate. Why, I hear very rarely asked, do, for instance, none of the Gulf states believe they have any role in alleviating that? How is it that a Kuwaiti official interviewed 6 months ago said, we don't have any Syrian refugees because they are from a different culture from us? And they are brutalized people. You think they'd be better off in Norway?
Okay, thank you for that, Douglas. Douglas, a question coming back at you specifically. Your Islamophobic views imply that you want all Muslims to be apologists for ISIS. The majority of Muslims condemn ISIS as barbaric. You are acclimating the majority, and promoting the minority, which are barbarians. Is that...
I don't think I said that, but...
By the way, they add violent minorities exist.
Well,
all
really. Look, if there's many ways to answer this point, but I would simply direct you to Pew polls, which I think most people regard as being a pretty good source of unbiased data. Look at any Pew polls of recent years across the Middle East and see what the views are on a whole range of issues to do with violence, the use of violence. I have never said that it's a majority, but take, for instance, the following. After the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris in January 2015, the BBC conducted a poll of British Muslim opinion, and 27% of British Muslims polled said that they had some sympathy with the people who attacked a newspaper office in Paris and killed 10 journalists and 2 policemen, including a Muslim. So my view is, and always has been, despite whatever words people try to put in my mouth, that this is a violent minority, but it is not quite such a minority that as we would be comfortable with, who don't have some lingering regard or act as apologists for that. And let me give you one other very, very quick example. 2 weeks ago in the UK, a major opinion poll, the most detailed to date, from ICM with Channel 4, was released in the UK. It included not just views on violence, but views on treatment of women, treatment of minorities. 52% of British Muslims polled said that they want homosexuality to be made illegal in Britain. Illegal. It should be a crime. 52%. Okay? And the younger ones, it's the same. So it's not as if it's, you know, it's a dying out thing. The younger ones want this. Now, the striking thing to me is that in any other community, I would argue, if such a poll were to come out, the other 48% would say, "My God, what has happened to our community? Why is such a horrible view so prevalent?" But that wasn't the response. The response from a totality of British Muslim leadership was to condemn the polling company. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a very big problem. And you can either face up to it and try to deal with the consequences, or you can dismiss those who point to it.
Thank you.
52% said that they wanted homosexuality to be illegal in Britain.
Alan, here's something directed at you. Would you consider Israel to be an artificial state in the Middle East, and what do you think of its future?
Well, how far in history do you want to go back on this one? If you look at ancient countries in the Middle East, you have Egypt, okay, long history there, and you have Israel, because you have a book that speaks of it thousands of years ago. So therefore, that in itself suggests a historic connection to the modern-day state that nothing else in the region can speak of, with the exception of Egypt. That in itself will tell you that this is not a, you know, kind of a construct of recent times, but something that has a long-rooted history in the area. The holy sites spoken of in the Bible exist today. They're there. For all the nonsense you get now from the Palestinian Authority, the temple never existed. It clearly did. Plenty of archaeologists there to support that case in point. There are historic links in that current state to what exists today. And really the question is, you know, I think people have to get away from this idea that uniquely among all nations, Israel has no right to exist. It seems extraordinary that in 2016 this can be a serious viewpoint anywhere. There are many artificial states in the world created by many squalid deals. Israel isn't one of them. And let's not forget it was created by the United Nations in a vote. Okay, it wasn't carved up on the back of an envelope somewhere. It exists because it was created by a vote of the United Nations. That should tell you all you need to know.
By the way, so very quickly, I have to add to that, by the way, there was a state created then that the foundation of which caused unbelievable amounts of bloodshed and sectarianism, and is one of the countries in the world today which is causing most global terrorism, and it's called Pakistan. And from one year to the next, I would never expect in any discussion about Pakistan, which is a country with all sorts of admirable things about it and all sorts of problems, but I have never heard anyone say that the result of that is that the state of Pakistan should be abolished. I've never heard that, and nor would you. That is not even an old discussion. It's a defunct discussion. It's done. It should be in my mind that it should be the same with the state of Israel. I'm amazed that it isn't, but it always tells you a lot more about the people asking the question.
Review the context. I just want to take a little bit of a sidebar and ask my own question here. Coming back to your country, the Labour Party is at this point in time suffering, I think, quite an indignity by the revelations of leading members of the Labour Party being openly anti-Semitic, and many of them proclaim Israel does not have a right to exist. How do you see that playing out in British politics at the moment, and how serious is this problem of anti-Semitism in Britain and also across Europe?
Ken Livingstone, who has been at the centre of this, is a very, very old and close enemy of mine. And I'm extremely pleased to see the general public catch up with me on the subject of Ken Livingstone. Most interesting, those of us who study Livingstonology were very interested in his...
Sorry, Ken Livingstone, for those who don't know, was the former mayor of London.
And senior party leadership of the Labour Party, and has just been suspended from the Labour Party. Ken Livingstone said in an interview the other day something that was very, very revealing. He was on the Daily Politics, and he said on the BBC, I have never seen any anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I've been there all my life. I don't believe it. I think this is got up by people against it. But he swiftly moved on to discussing which of Hitler's early policies he didn't think were mad and so on, but which is never a good place to be. But the interesting thing, and the thing that has almost not been picked up on, was that he went on to say, because the specific reason this came about was because of a Labour MP called Naz Shah, who's also now since been suspended from the party, who had said some things on social media during the last Gaza conflict. So Ken Livingstone says in this interview the other day, you've got to realise he said this during a period of heightened tensions, because it was a period during which the Israelis were once again brutally slaughtering the Palestinian peoples. Now, you see, that, to my mind, right there, is the source of the problem. You see, even in today's Labour Party, if you went in many places and said, God, the Jews, you wouldn't be welcomed. The Oxford University Labour Club did have recently an expose on it saying that actually people did basically say that sort of thing. But in the higher echelons of the party, that would not be acceptable. But here's the strange conundrum they're in. They cannot understand where the anti-Semitism of grassroots members and of representatives and councillors and others, people praising Adolf Hitler and so on, they cannot understand where this comes from. And some of that lack of understanding, I think, is genuine. And with the next breath, they say, this happened during a time of heightened tensions whilst the Israelis were brutally slaughtering the Palestinians again. Now, is it any wonder you might be producing a new generation of anti-Semites if you constantly pump into the political discourse the idea that the only Jewish state in the world, repeatedly and for no apparent reason, and not targeted against Hamas, not targeted against the Hamas household and warning people in advance of that, but just deliberately, constantly, routinely, boringly, desiredly, killing Palestinians. Is it any wonder you might end up with an anti-Semitism problem? So they have this problem of trying to put the fires out, and they don't realize that they are the arsonists.
Do you see any distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism?
Well, the answer to this is obvious. I mean, there is a distinction, but you'll tend to find pretty quickly that most people who loudly profess anti-Zionism, unless there's somebody who hates all forms of nationalism and wants the abolition of all nation states, actually turn out to be anti-Semites. It's surprising, amazing that of all the countries they want to talk about nationalism of, it's always Israel, the one that they really... They don't talk about Irish nationalism. They don't talk about French nationalism. They don't talk about various forms of African nationalism. That's not interesting to them. But Israeli nationalism is, Zionism is, just because it's got that name. Seems to me that's an anti-Semite rather than anything else in that way. And the other way you can easily tell it is the tactics utilized. It's perfectly fine to be critical of an Israeli government policy. I know many people who would be critical of various parts of Israeli government policy, just they would be of many other countries' policy. Nobody would say that would turn you into a rabid anti-Semite for doing so. But when the language you use is extraordinary in its terminology, when, for example, the word Nazi suddenly appears, the word ghetto comes into it, concentration camps, genocide suddenly appears in the conversation with a very particular connotation for Jewish people in that, then you realize you're not dealing with an anti-Zionist, you're dealing with an anti-Semite. And when, uniquely, again, they're using that one standard, double standard, and saying Israel does X, Y, and Z, and ignoring the rest of the human rights abuses everywhere else in the world, indeed under their nose, then you end up with, again, that case in point. And by the way, it's the saddest part of this, of all of this, is that it's not even motivated by any genuine concern for the Palestinian people. That's the saddest part of this whole discussion, full stop. The number of times I've been with Palestinians who've told me, if only these people who are complaining about Israel would actually come and help us build a state in Palestine, we'd love that to happen, but all they want to do is boycott Israel. They're not interested in actually helping us. It seems to me utterly bizarre that this has become, again, one of the leading campaigns of the 21st century, this desire to delegitimize Israel, to boycott Israel, when there is so much wrong in the world, and Israel is one of the few right things.
By the way, I'm conscious we should try to get in another question. But could I also make what might be an interesting general point on this? I think that the whole moral calculus of European politics, and specifically British politics, is very subtly shifting at the moment. And this issue actually highlights this shift. In our country, much like in yours, it has always been a bomb that was always at threat of going off under the right, the political right, in that the political right could forever risk the accusation of racism. And for many years now, a generation, let's say, it was assumed that the political left was by its nature anti-racist. Those of you who saw the recent very amusing documentary about the Buckley-Vidal debates will remember this point. That it was always the Buckley problem that at some point Vidal might detonate the racist accusation, the Nazi accusation under Buckley, which of course he did with such spectacular effect. But the interesting thing about this discussion is that increasingly in Europe, the realization is settling in that the left is where racism is now coming from. And that will have profound consequences in the long term. It will have profound consequences for the way that ethnic minorities vote, and it will have profound consequences for the left's own moral vitality. Because if the thing you have built a very substantial part of your political identity on is shown to be a lie, what are the other moral attributes you have? This is my urge to left-wing activists, to left-wing politicians and others, to stop this now, because otherwise down the road they have nothing, no moral legitimacy, and they may need it.
Interesting point. Thank you. One question, and we've got to start looking at the clock here. Aleppo, which is the second largest city in Syria, is potentially about to fall. Will this represent a victory for Assad and a defeat for President Obama?
Well, it's actually the largest city in Syria, number one. But of course it will. If Assad retakes a city, which frankly he had no ability to retake without the assistance of the Iranians in particular and the Russians, then of course it's a massive blow for President Obama, because the war is not going to come any closer to conclusion if Aleppo is taken. Absolutely not. That's not going to happen. There'll be more bloodshed as a result, so more deaths essentially, someone's got to have some account of them. And it will be America's enemies, not America's friends, who will have gained the advantage from doing so. So it's a pretty clear-cut victory for Assad on that one, and defeat for President Obama.
And I think finally, in deference to you, Celia, we've been given another few minutes to take some questions. in deference to Celia's visit to Jordan, the question really posed is, do you think Jordan will stay safe and stable in the current circumstances? And what are the implications if not?
It's anyone's guess. I would have said yes today. I would have thought less so only a couple of years ago. The situation domestically, I haven't been there for a couple of years now, but it was obviously there was a moment when it looked very difficult, and where I think that there, among other things, lack of desire to be used as a proxy army to sort out Syria was understandable because of the domestic problem at home. If I may, and I may have more to say on that, if I may, by the way, sorry, I'm very conscious in a discussion on this, we haven't raised the issue of Turkey, but maybe it's worth raising simply because at the moment, in our country, Turkey is probably the country that is most discussed on this. Tomorrow, the European Commission is expected to approve the visa waiver deal that allows visa-free travel throughout the Schengen area in Europe. And this also is something that is likely to become one of the biggest political footballs of this year. The deal that Erdogan approved with Merkel is now being used in this way to fast-track essentially all the rights you need for travel to 75 million citizens of Turkey. This is a huge thing because it causes enormous public concern in Europe and is likely, in my view, to mean that elections like that in Austria the other day that saw the Freedom Party of Austria, generally described as the far-right party of Austria, do so well in the polls, will be something you will see replicated everywhere else. It's also worth saying very quickly, because there is enormous public concern in Germany and across Europe now about something very specific that happened a month ago when a German comedian insulted Erdogan on public television in Germany and is now facing up to 4 years in jail in Germany. The sight of lese majeste laws of Turkey being used against Turkish journalists and Turkish citizens is a tragedy, an abomination, and something sadly which the world has become used to. But the idea that Erdogan is able to do this to a European citizen, and not just him, the Turkish consul in Rotterdam was found the other day trying to persuade Turkish Dutch citizens to complain about a Dutch comedian who'd also insulted Erdogan to prosecute a Dutch comedian. I mention these things because sometimes in these sort of things, these very big underlying issues are the ones one misses out. But if John Stewart were about to face 4 years in jail for insulting Kim Jong-un, I would hope there would be a public outcry.
I should point out this may be Douglas's last public appearance, as he's running a poetry competition insulting President Erdogan.
Well, I said the only decent right thing you can do as a free citizen after that happens is to insult President Erdogan. So I led the way with a limerick and offered to my readers that everyone else should insult President Erdogan. And by 12 hours in, a reader had offered £1,000 cash prize. So it's now, if you follow my advice and do a limerick, which is, of course, a five-line form of incredible beauty, you can get paid £200 a line, which to my view, and there may be poets in the audience, this is San Francisco after all, with a fine literary tradition, I put it out there because this is now probably the best paid poetry prize anywhere in the world. And I believe it's called the Streisand effect. It makes President Erdogan now the most insulted leader in the world, and I'm enormously proud of that. But yes, I may.
In effect, he's actually.
I may have to claim asylum in San Francisco. Well, it doesn't seem so bad. It's better weather, and
friendly locals.
Russia, we haven't actually looked at Russia, and somebody asked a rather long question about Russia, but basically, what's Russia's, quite obvious, but what's Russia's interest in that part of the world in terms of strengthening their own hegemon in the region? Do you want to talk just a little bit about that?
It's actually very simple. ever since he's come to power, President Putin has, for a number of years, attempted to obviously maximize the impact that Russia has in various parts of the world. Usually, that sort of exercise is conducted in opposition to whatever the West might seemingly want to do in exchange. Now, what we have to give to Putin, he's been remarkably successful at this over the years. He has seized opportunities, seen weakness in his opponents, and been able to derive tactical considerations for it. In the Middle East, it's quite simple. Syria is essentially the last client state Russia has in the region. There is a Russian naval base there. There's been a long-standing relationship with the Assads that's gone back many years. So there was a desire not to see a client state lost in the first place. But added to that, you, of course, had the weakness of the West, which enabled him to play for the last 2-3 years the role of arbiter of Syria, which he did over the chemical weapons red line, firstly, then with his stunning intervention, then with his alleged sort of withdrawal of intervention, where he is making the weather over there. What this does is essentially keeps him at the top table of international diplomacy, where he had managed to freeze himself out of because of his invasion of Crimea, Ukraine, and Eastern Ukraine, and was facing a freeze by the Europeans and the Americans on that. The Syrian move has to be seen in the context of trying to restore him in international favour. It's not going to work in the sense that everyone knows his full game, but at the same time, he has managed to insert himself back in the conversation in a way few people could have seen 2 years ago. Of course, the problem for Putin is that he always plays a very short-term game. Brilliant tactically, disastrous strategically. He's still stuck in Ukraine. The sanctions are still there. That's not moving. The vice is being squeezed. And no matter how much he thrashes around in other places, that's not going to change. So keep an eye on that situation, and particularly with the collapse of the oil price, it seems to me that the Russians are engaged in a very dangerous game for themselves and indeed for everyone else's security by their repeated interventions elsewhere.
Well, desperate men do desperate things. Mm. What could he do?
The worst case scenario is, given you could end up with some kind of clash with a NATO force of some kind, whether that is Turkish, given the antipathy between Russia and Turkey at the moment, there's a strong possibility of an accidental clash there, some kind of mistaken clash with a Western force that's also engaged in the air against ISIS could happen. What you don't want is to end up with some kind of confrontation with him. That's the worst-case scenario.
I'm sure you want to squeeze in one more, but just quickly also, of course, something which is not commented on enough, but from the Russian point of view, I think is important, is that Putin sees that in the 90s, after the Balkans, a large number of people from the Caucasus in particular went and got the kind of training that Alan described earlier that is so central to effective terrorist attacks. And there is definitely a security concern of the Russians that with the number of Russians and people from their sphere of influence, as they see it, who have gone to Syria in recent years, they do fear very much what happens when those people return to Russia, just as this country fears about what happens when Americans who have been trained by ISIS returns here.
Okay, and looking perhaps to the final question, I do apologize to anyone whose question just didn't get through. I really have tons of them. I'm trying to keep it within a general theme. One of the things that obviously is emerging in the Middle East in order to try and deter the proliferation of nuclear advancement is the collaboration, perhaps not so overtly, between Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and Israel. Could something positive develop out of that from a political standpoint, which might forge new alliances and help stabilize the Middle East?
Well, I wouldn't expect embassies to be opened too soon. Or for a multi-faith prayer room to be opened in Mecca. It's interesting, as I alluded to earlier, that there is a very slight nodding to the to what is going on and to what everyone knew was happening in private anyway. I would say that might simply be the thing for some time to come. We've seen it before in the region of other countries who benefit from Israeli security advice, who don't like to say so. And I think most people are used to that being the arrangement, and one might regret it or otherwise, but that's just the reality.
My only parting thought on that is, well, it may make a slight difference strategically in the level of proxy wars being fought across the region and other places, But, you know, we have to come back to the basic reality, unfortunately, about the Saudis. The Saudis are not a, if you like, a status quo power in the sense that what, you know, that their continued survival is an, you know, unmitigated good for the world. Let's not forget who are the main funders of radical Islam around the world. It's the Saudis. Through the form of Wahhabi Islam, they pump into Western countries, and which does, in fact, pervert a lot of the local Islam you find in many other places. And, you know, from that perspective, there is a regime that is hand in glove with that, even if it doesn't practice it itself, as we well know. And that is a, you know, kind of a long-term battle that the existence of the Saudi state in its current form is going to lead to us to be engaged in a very curious, you know, about face where we're on the one hand friendly to the Saudis, but on the other hand know that they are funding the very elements in our society we wish to suppress.
By the way, that's cracking, isn't it? I mean, the silence on that cracked some time ago, but now there's the real momentum behind it. In the 1980s, when the documentary Death of a Princess was aired in the UK, it caused unbelievable problems. It was never shown again. It was sort of repressed, suppressed. Today, barely a week goes by when a major story of internal repression in Saudi Arabia doesn't make the news headlines in the UK and across every other country. And so I think that is a change, and I think that governments are going to have to respond to that. Either they're going to have to explain to the public, we have a set of awful options, and this is a demonstration of that, or they will have to try to hold a line, which, as I say, is increasingly unsustainable. It is viewed, it is seen, it is visible to the public what the nature of the Saudi regime is. And governments who ally themselves wholeheartedly with it without putting some health warnings in will bring trouble upon themselves.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to also remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called The New Middle East with Dr. Alan Mendoza and Douglas Murray. Unfortunately, we have to bring this to a close. I'd like to thank you, Alan, and you, Douglas, for a masterful sweep and analysis, an informative and illuminating talk today on the new Middle East and the ramifications beyond. We'd also like to thank our audiences here, those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Dr. Lenny Crystal, your moderator for today's program, The New Middle East. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 112 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.